One of the responsibilities of corporations is to take a really hard look at their CSR ESG departments and find ways to let that department loose in letting one of their primary missions and responsibilities being to diffuse the work that they do throughout the entire organization. It's messy, it's hard to keep track of, but it allows people throughout the organization to be involved in the good work that the company is doing that is real and true and not made up social washing or greenwashing.
Human trafficking doesn't always take the form we first imagine. It can be found at almost any level of an organization's supply chain. What can compliance professionals do to assess human trafficking risk, and how can they leverage the resources of the organizations they work for to help root out this tragic problem? Gwen Hassan is here to help. This is Hidden Traffic.
Hello, and welcome to a New Year's episode of Hidden Traffic. I am Gwen Hassan, and I'm thrilled today to have as my guest, Sean Askinosi. Sean has a long list, so bear with me. He is not only CEO of Askinosi Chocolate, he's also a TEDx speaker. He's an author. He and his daughter wrote a book entitled Meaningful Work, The Quest to Do Great Business, Find Your Calling, and Feed Your Soul. I love the name of that. He's also been named by Forbes one of the 25 best small companies in America. And I love this one, named by O, the Oprah magazine, one of 15 guys who are saving the world. That's big. That's huge. You're saving the world. That's fantastic. So welcome. I'm so thrilled to have you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you for the introduction. And by the way, that Oprah thing was a long time ago. So clearly I haven't saved the world yet.
Well, you know, you're on your way. Let's hope.
I'm on the way to saving me. That's my main objective.
Well, you know what? I mean, we could talk about Don Quixote and other examples. Every good journey towards saving the world starts with saving yourself. We can get all philosophical about, you know, not pouring from an empty cup, which I think is something a lot of people do, especially compliance professionals, right? Where they're so overextended that they don't take care of themselves.
In fact, this is what you raise is a perennial problem across all faith traditions. We could talk about any religious faith tradition that involves an element of activism, and people find what you just said, that they are so trapped by these activities, which are good and are just and driven out of love. But then they find that they are then sort of, when I say trapped, it's because they're kind of like lured into doing it again and again and again because it's good, because it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then they, by the time they know it, they've depleted themselves and there's nothing left. So yeah, this is a problem. And absolutely, I would imagine would be a problem for compliance professionals who find themselves in the middle of a large organization in which maybe they're having some challenges and having some challenges bringing people on board to the way they think things should be done.
We're a little off track, but I love this conversation. So we're going to keep going. There's this idea too amongst, I think it's changing, but amongst a lot of, especially corporate America, that it is the job of the compliance team to be compliant for the company. Like you could somehow carry the entire corporation on your back to the promised land of compliance, which of course is not at all feasible. The role of a compliance person is to be a coach and an advisor and a guide, and to a certain extent to proselytize, as you would in a faith tradition, the message of, you know, hey, here's why this matters. Here's why this is important. Here's the value that you bring to not only the organization, but to the world when you do things the right way.
You would be able to really, you're the expert about what I'm going to say, so I'm a little embarrassed, but for the sake of context, we can say that corporate social responsibility departments began in the 60s and they were populated by lawyers.
Yeah.
And so this idea of risk mitigation and now CSR departments, it's a very interesting blend that has now found itself 60 years later in this, what you just said, bearing the responsibility of social justice, ethics, mm-hmm. compliance, all on the backs and brains and minds of this department. And so one of the things that I advocate, and I'm very passionate about this, and I write about it in my book, and that is one of the responsibilities of corporations is to take a really hard look at their CSR ESG departments and find ways to let that department loose in letting one of their primary missions and responsibilities being to diffuse the work that they do throughout the entire organization. It's messy, it's hard to keep track of, but it allows people throughout the organization to be involved in the good work that the company is doing that is real and true and not made up social washing or greenwashing.
Greenwashing, which is so vitally important, especially now in the rise of my own children who are Gen Z children, who are demanding that yes. kind of real accountability of where they work and the alignment of their own personal values with the values of the company that they are slaving away for however many hours a day, that it's no longer going to be worth it to them mm-hmm. to work for a company whose values don't align, which led to, of course, then the great resignation and the great reshuffle and everything we're seeing now. I mean, so timely. What better time for a company to get on board Absolutely. With the Absolutely. Idea? Yeah.
Well, and I think it's particularly important that many of these departments are led by lawyers. And the reason is because lawyers are in a particularly unique position to, if I could say, speak truth to power. Mm. A lawyer can walk in the office of a CEO and speak to him or her in a way that almost has instant credibility compared to perhaps others in the organization. A lawyer can say, hey, you need to stop doing this.
Yeah.
This company is going to be in trouble, or the opposite of, we need to be doing this in order to be better corporate citizens and to remain vibrant in our community. Lawyers are in a really good position to do that, to lead that.
I hope you're right. Yes, I do too. All right, I'm going to get us back on track, which is thank you so much for all of that. But let's talk a little bit about how you got here, which is obviously you've been in leading your own as your own CEO company for a while. But what drew you to work in this kind of a sustainability space, CSR space, clean supply chain space? And why chocolate? Which, by the way, I'm a huge fan of. Mm-hmm. I eat it every day. So I
bless you.
Let me know. Tell us a little bit about how you went from a criminal defense attorney to found your own chocolate company.
I did criminal law for about 20 years, and I really felt like I was called to that from a young age, and I wanted to be a lawyer, and particularly I wanted to practice criminal law. And so I did it. I specialized in serious felony cases throughout that almost 20 years, and I love the courtroom, love getting ready for the courtroom, and it didn't feel like work to me. But these types of cases, murder, robbery, rape, drug cases, some of those cases can be very, very taxing emotionally, can really be stressful. And I think prosecutors often are in the same boat, public defenders, police officers.
Yeah.
You can only work in that space for so long, and you either find a way, inhabit that space, or you leave. And for me, I needed to leave. And so I tried other areas of the law and just see if it would continue to inspire me, and it really didn't. So I just tried to think of things that I could do, and I didn't know how to do anything else. I didn't really have any hobbies. I didn't know, you know, I was a political science major and I didn't take any business classes, and I'm not really particularly mechanical. So I got a hobby of grilling and then baking and making desserts, and I was looking at businesses to buy or start, and I spent about 5 years on this path. And this is what I write about in the book. I spent about 5 years searching. I wanted to do something inspiring. You know, I was inspired to practice law, and I wanted to have that sense of passion again. And that was hard. That was really hard to find the right thing. And I struggled with it and went through a lot of emotional turmoil about that, the way a lot of people do, who are people who need to find their work engaging and need to be passionate about what they do during the day. And so anyway, I landed on chocolate by just really through chocolate desserts. And then this was back when nobody in the U.S. was really making bean to bar chocolate. There were a few of us starting at the same time, and we really didn't know each other. But within a few months of having this idea to make chocolate from scratch, I was in the Amazon. And wow. I was learning how farmers influence the flavor of chocolate by how they harvest the beans. And then it just kind of started from there. And then I came back and started to wind down my law practice and bought a building and started to buy equipment from around the world. And now here I am 16 years later.
That's fantastic. I love the passion-driven career journey. And I think it's increasingly common. I'm so glad to see that because I've seen over my career, I've been practicing law now for 25 years, and I meet a lot of lawyers who really hate what they do and mm-hmm. who are so unhappy mm-hmm. and are not passionate about what they do. And they feel like they're caught in a grind and they've now got a lifestyle that they want to continue to support and kids they want to support. So they continue practicing, but their heart's not in it. And stories like yours of people who are intentional about finding work that they find rewarding and passionate is wonderful.
You mentioned earlier, the best example of this are your own children. I mean, They are the ones that are driving this, and they and their fellow young people, you know, they're the ones that are changing the landscape of all of the things that we're talking about. They're the ones that are changing the landscape of social justice and new supply chains and accountability. And it's a very exciting thing for me. We have a program called Chocolate University, where we engage young people in our community, Springfield, Missouri, where I'm located, to teach them, one, that small business can be a force for good in the world, and that there is a world beyond Springfield, Missouri. And in particular, mm-hmm. we have this business immersion program for high school students. It's a part of our Chocolate University Foundation program. And we take them to Tanzania, and we mm-hmm. let them experience this business model. So it's not like they're on a mission trip. It's more of them being on an international business trip. And we've been doing this for 12 years. And so I've had the opportunity to interview applicants that are juniors and seniors in high school now for 12 years. And so I'm seeing what you're seeing. And I love the chance to interview these high school students and really come away just so inspired and encouraged and optimistic about the future of this world.
Yeah.
Because of the awareness that young people have, I think is just, to me, it's amazing and really inspiring.
Cause for hope. Absolutely.
Yes, for sure.
So tell our listeners a little bit more about Eskenazi Chocolate. So I understand just from reading your website that you are sourcing 100% of your beans from farmers that you then are sharing your profits with. And I mean, I'll tell you, I know next to nothing about chocolate except that I like eating it. So how does that model differ from what other chocolate companies do? Give us kind of a chocolate 101, if you would.
Sure. Most companies buy their cocoa beans from brokers.
Okay.
Not a big surprise there. Probably the way you would buy other commodities, I guess. And so I don't even know a broker to buy. So I've purchased beans directly from farmers since the first bean buy that we've made. And we post that on our website. We post every bean buy we've ever made, what we paid the farmer, and how that compares to the world market price, the fair trade price, which I don't believe in fair trade chocolate. That could be a whole other episode. But more importantly, the farm gate price, the sort of proverbial price that farmers could get at their farm gate. That's really where the rubber meets the road and the apples to apples comparison. What you see in looking at our bean buys over all these years is we've paid farmers directly, helped them open bank accounts, and we've paid them about 55% more than they would have otherwise received at Farmgate over all those years. And in about 70% of cases, we've provided them with advance payments, sometimes months, 6, 8 months, 9 months in advance of us shipping out these cocoa beans. So we're essentially giving them interest-free loans so they can finance their harvesting operations in 4 origins. And then I travel to these places, except during the pandemic, and I have restarted travel. This past May, I went to Tanzania, and then in about 10 days, I'll be in the Philippines, and it'll be my 46th origin trip since I started the company.
Gosh.
And so this is all part of what we call direct trade. And as you mentioned, we share profits with farmers and always have, and we translate our financials into their language so they can understand how we calculate the profit share. And so when I was in Tanzania in May, our financials were in Swahili. And this is part of open book management and something that I've practiced for years and years. And I think that really is a different model than what most chocolate makers around the world use. Most of them are acquiring beans from brokers. And it's not that they aren't traveling, you know, to see farms. It's just that there's not as direct a line between chocolate maker and farmer.
and farmer. Yeah. If my reading is correct, as in, say, conflict minerals, oftentimes a problem where you're getting beans that purport to be from a clean farm, but aren't, because they are shipped through multiple middlemen and or they're dropped at a farm where they were actually farmed somewhere else, and you don't know what the actual practices are. If some of the cases that have been filed against the Nestle's of the world and the Mars are accurate, then there's a big problem with not having direct relationship with your farmers, because you don't know what happens in the middle. Children being trafficked to work.
Yes. Well, the Department of Labor estimates with ILO that there are currently 1.58 million children in the supply chain. Yeah. The cocoa supply chain in Ghana and Ivory Coast, where, as you said, those companies you mentioned, Hershey, Mars, Barry Callebaut, Nestle, that's where they supply most, or where they receive most of their supply of cocoa beans. And it's this problem of using enslaved children in West Africa is not new. And most all those companies I just mentioned signed the Harkin-Engel Protocol in 2003 and pledged to eliminate child slavery from their supply chain. And now here we are in 2023, and all of those companies declare in their annual reports every year that they're doing everything they can to combat and reduce and eliminate this terrible tragedy of children working on farms. And by the way, I should say, of the 1.5 million kids that are in the supply chain, the estimates are, and really not disputed, that over 70% of those kids are involved in what's called the worst forms of child labor. Mm-hmm. So think 8-year-old with a machete or carrying a backpack of fertilizer. Mm-hmm. And I should say also, the context of this is that even among smallholder farmers in that area who are adults and not children, they are subsisting on approximately $1.20 a day. So they're hovering right around the United Nations definition of extreme poverty.
Yeah.
And there are multiple studies that indicate a causal connection between the price of the commodity paid to the farmer and the deployment and use of enslaved children on the farm. So another way of saying it is, if they would pay farmers more money directly, they would find a diminishment of the use of children on the farms. And there's this economic causality. Anyway, this is a problem. I should conclude this little part by saying that these companies, Nestle and others, say, well, we admit that there's a problem. Yes, we are moving the goalposts every chance we get to lengthen the time that we say that this problem is going to be addressed and removed from our worries and concerns. But then they say the fact that we've admitted it is now being held against us by, for example, formerly enslaved children who have sued Nestle, who lost in the U.S. Supreme Court in June of 21. So they then claim to have no direct knowledge. They use their supply chain as a defense. And it's not a defense, and it shouldn't be a defense. And here we are in 2023, and publicly traded corporations are allowed to exist in super complex supply chains, not necessarily because they're more economically beneficial, but because they allow them to hide. Yeah. And we should not permit that.
It gives them that plausible deniability argument oh, it's so complex, we can't possibly have visibility to it. I saw one of those aforementioned companies publish in their CSR sustainability ESG report a very proud and kind of bragging statement that they had achieved a place where 55% of their cocoa supply chain was child labor free.
Yeah.
And they were so proud of that. I actually posted, wow, talk about a spin job, because that's the same as saying we enslave children for 45% of the chocolate that we make. How can you be proud of that kind of a figure when your figure is zero? And yes, you pay more, but it's worth it because you're protecting the supply chain all the way through.
I believe that these companies should be held to account. And the problem, I think, is that many, if not all of these companies are so beholden to share price and shareholders and profit that they believe internally that there's no way out, you know, that there isn't a resolution to this without diminished profitability in the company. And they will use that as kind of a rationale to do all kinds of things, not the least of which is find a way to manipulate these third-party certifying, supposedly independent reports to their benefit. And that's why I have a real problem with third-party certifications. And when you follow the money, it's often these places are not as independent as they seem. And there's a very, very sophisticated marketing department in all of these cases that honestly, and for much of it, work hand in hand with their CSR departments and ESG. They sort of conspire, I believe, to paint the rosiest picture they possibly can for shareholders and the consumer-facing public. And they're very, very good at it. And they do it not just with this issue of enslaved children. I mean, we find the issue of social washing and greenwashing. It is replete in these annual reports. And one of the things that I'd be really curious to know what you think about this. Again, this is an area I'm treading very lightly because you are the expert about what I'm going to say. I think that we need to make these sustainability claims fall within generally accepted auditing principles.
Mm-hmm.
These accounting standards have their origins in the 1933 and 1934 Securities Exchange Acts.
After and the shareholders, stock
exchange. Yeah. And shareholders have come to rely on these accounting principles and auditing standards. And so why can't we force these American publicly traded corporations to adhere to that standard? And if they miss, they should be subject to the liability that anyone would be subject to if they violate those principles. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think we're headed that way. But I think it's going to be slower than any of us want, because until we can get an agreed upon set of standards, whether they're the GRI standards or something else, the ability to apple to apple or orange to orange, even apple to orange, is not currently available. There is, I actually teach a class on ESG, as I think you know, at Loyola's Law School. Yep. One of my favorite slides for my students is there's a ranking system out there on ESG and how good of a company you are from a sustainability standpoint. There are five different rankings of Apple. Apple is ranked as A+ by one of the ratings agencies, the best sustainability company out there. One of the other ones rates them as a D-. And it's arguably the same set of things that they are looking at, but there isn't an agreed upon standard. There isn't an agreed upon measure. And until we get there, which I think we're still a couple of years away from, we won't then be able to translate that into the kind of SEC rules that SEC has been talking about now for years as well. But I think there's hope on the horizon that we are driving towards that, and we'll get to a place where you've got the ability to compare companies truly on a standardized basis and hold them accountable for what they're saying. So I think it's coming. I think you're right on track, but it's going to require more patience because we're not going to be there this year. That's for sure.
Well, I mean, accounting firms charge for this. I mean, if an accounting firm is willing to sign their name on the dotted line of an audit and stand by it, they know what happens if they're wrong.
Yeah.
And I think it needs that kind of accountability. I hope it can get to that place.
I hope so too. I agree with you. It'll be really interesting to see too, then how that translates into corporate America in terms of what I hope will be then a recognition that all of this, whether it's SEC compliance from a finance standpoint, or whether it's your sustainability or ESG program, all of it relates to risk reduction. And at its core, this is a risk practice. And so companies who aren't paying attention to this are by default accepting a much higher risk profile that should then drive shareholder decisions. You know, whether or not you're going to invest in a company should be driven in part by what you think their risk practices are. Are they a risky company? Are they not? Do they have a risk philosophy where they are knowingly trying to reduce risk, or are they out there just flying by the seat of their pants? So hopefully we'll get there eventually. I want to go back to what you mentioned about third-party auditing firms, because so many people rely on when I say people, I mean corporations and their employees rely on outside auditors with the idea of outsourcing the due diligence of their supply chain. So they'll hire an outside supply chain auditing company to do the work for them and tell them whether or not their different suppliers are clean or not. I take it you're not a proponent of that model, given that you don't use it yourself. And you mentioned kind of the corruption that can be present in those models. And I wanted to say I agree with you 100% on that. And it reminds me a lot of a case I've talked about previously on the podcast, which is actually a human trafficking case related to rubber gloves, the Top Glove case, where they had an outside auditing firm who reviewed this operation of theirs in Malaysia and came back and said that there were no signs of trafficking. And this was, you know, a clean operation, gave them an A on a review standard. Less than 12 months later, revised their rating and gave them a D after Channel 4 in the UK got a hidden camera in and filmed conditions in that plant. So again, it really raises the question, are those outsourced auditing firms worthwhile at all? Is it in fact better than nothing? Maybe not. Maybe the only solution is that you have to do it yourself. What do you think about that?
You and I agree on this. And I mean, yes, you're right. We do this ourselves. And I think it's what you said earlier. I mean, it's a case of plausible deniability when you can cede responsibility of a major part of your organization to someone else. And these companies that we're speaking of would not cede quality to a third party and then say, well, this third party says that we have good tasting chocolate. So I guess you can believe them. They handle this internally and they depend on it internally and hire a lot of people to make sure that it's the quality that they expect with quality assurance departments and everything else. So I also think that when we cede the responsibility of something this sacred, and I do
fundamental.
Believe,
it's
fundamental. And I don't use the word sacred lightly. I mean, we're talking about, for the most part, we're talking about people. We're talking about human beings. We're talking about children.
Yeah.
And these are not just numbers in a report or images in a annual report that you hired some photographer to take. These are real human souls. And so I take this as sacred. And if you're going to cede the responsibility of the care of that to an outside third party, then I think it sends the wrong message to the people inside your company. So I think that this, to me, is a core principle of an organization, and organizations really need to rethink that idea because of the message that it sends to employees within the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways, of course, to bring all of this in-house and to handle it in-house, and to send the message that it is sacred, it is important, and we are going to take the time and money and resources required to do this imperfectly, but with more intention.
But ethically, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I know you've described your business model as, you know, luxury goods with a purpose, which I love. What advice do you have for compliance professionals who are not working in companies that have been purpose-built like yours have, where they're trying to push the agenda of a clean supply chain and human rights protection within the supply chain, you know, elimination of forced and child labor? Where do they start? What are your thoughts as to what someone in a non-purpose-built organization can do?
Well, let's say that this was one of your children or one of my grandchildren, you know, and they were coming to us and saying on this podcast, if they were on the call, what would we tell them if they asked this question? And the truth is, we'd probably tell them to quit. If this was a publicly traded company and my granddaughter, Goldie, was a fairly newly minted lawyer inside the CSR department at some publicly traded company that was so-called wrestling with these issues of social justice and enslaved children and all of these things that we've been talking about, I really think that unless they can find alignment in the C-suite, and I mean real alignment, not marketing alignment.
Yeah.
But shared philosophy.
Commitment.
And commitment. Yeah. Then it's pretty much a lost cause. I'm sorry to say that. And I think then it's kind of like people in my faith world often, you know, and I've heard this said by theologians, and they're like, well, what does God want me to do? Or what is God's will? And one of the things that I love about theologians who say, oh, well, you want to know what God has in store for you or what God's will is for you, go find where God is working and join that. So I would use similar advice to young people who find themselves trapped in a CSR department of disaligned or misaligned philosophies with the C-suite and say, go join this work where you can be part of this work and be part of moving the ball forward. Because if you're in a large organization as a young lawyer or a young practitioner in this field, I think you're swimming upstream unless you can find alignment and build coalitions across departments, not just CSR, that will have influence in the C-suite, then it's, I hate to say it, but it's a lost cause. So I think these people need to find organizations that seem to be aligned with their philosophy so they can join them and be a part of this work and make things better, or start their own organizations and become entrepreneurs and small businesses that are hopefully going to grow and touch more people. So kind of like we were saying at the outset, really what we're after here is we're after the people that we're talking about now who are expressing dissatisfaction or need advice about what to do in order to influence their company. We need to remind them also that really their real responsibility, and this is Gandhian, but the real responsibility is that they change their own heart, that there's an interior transformation of themselves, and that they take a little bit of the burden off of themselves that they feel for changing the world and changing everybody else around them. They will find a sort of key that unlocks this door, this mystery, if they can spend the time professionally and personally to work on themselves.
Yeah.
And then they will find it easier and a lighter burden and a clearer path to alignment with others in the organization. Maybe that's a little too, I don't mean to sound new agey about this. It's just it's just what I believe.
No, I think we're already seeing that. We are seeing more and more people, even old Gen Xers like me, who are voting with their feet, you know, who are deciding, hey, I spent 2 years in my house during a pandemic that gave me a lot of time to think about what I'm doing with my life. And I'm not pleased with where my value set is in comparison to how I'm spending my time. And so I'm going to change that, and I'm going to do something different. I'm going to find a new role. I'm going to, in my case, start a podcast. I'm going to do something to try and spend more of my time in alignment with my own values. So I think the more we see young people make that decision for themselves, the harder it's going to be for the big corporations to find people. And we're already seeing that.
The
demand for talent is huge now. So that may, by default, drive some change into corporate America, simply because they won't be able to find people that are good at what they're doing if they're not giving people space to be in alignment with a corporate culture that they can support and believe in. So, I mean, as maybe, you know, glass half full, Pollyanna optimistic as this sounds, I do think that what you recommend and that personal alignment, when it happens in enough volume, which we're starting to see, will in and of itself be a force for change. So I'm hopeful that we're seeing that.
Yeah, we'll see this tidal wave of change once we reflect back on it and we have a chance to see what's happening. You and I are fortunate to be, we get to be part of it. You know, we get to see it happening around us. And so like you, I'm encouraged by this.
I am as well. So let's get a little more practical, which is, how can people find your chocolate? And if they want to learn more about you or get in contact with you, how do they do that?
Well, first of all, thanks for mentioning that about the chocolate. And people can go to our website, askanosi.com, and there's a zip code locator so they can see if there's chocolate in their town sold at a specialty food store nearby or a coffee shop. Or they can just order directly from our website, and we ship really quickly. And we're a really small company. I haven't mentioned that. We're about 21 full-time employees, and that's it, including my daughter and I. And so getting a hold of me is pretty easy too. I have a website, seanaskanosi.com. People can email me directly from that website and try to answer everything that I can, questions that people have about the book or talks that I've given. And so, yeah, easy to get a hold of.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. It's been enlightening, interesting, and just fun. I really enjoyed the conversation with you. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Gwen.